This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. We're going to leave the deck of the Masonic, leave the crew, and head back to the Hawaiian Islands, where the albatross chicks are getting bigger and bigger. We're going to be traveling to Midway, not Tern Island, where we've been before, or the other more remote islands. Midway is more accessible. I'm reading from the book Eye of the Albatross by Carl Safina, published in 2002. The subtitle is Visions of Hope and Survival. One of the Lazen albatrosses that Safina is following closely has a satellite transmitter, and he knows where she is, thousands of miles out on the ocean, to search for food for her chick. This chapter is called Midway. Amelia is down to a lean, athletic weight, fit and tuned. She has invested the last trip, 2 weeks, in her chick. During this trip, Amelia ranged only about 1,100 miles from her nest to the southern edge of the subarctic frontal zone. She's pursuing an eminently reasonable strategy, intermediate effort for intermediate rewards that will be invested mostly in the large chick's rapid growth. If she stayed close, she wouldn't find as much food, and she needs more food for a chick that's now so big enough to wait the extra days. But if she went on month-long trips each time, she'd benefit at the expense of her chick, who would be left to contend with her prolonged absence, disproportionately dependent on Dad. So during this last foraging trip, she traveled an immense clockwise, roughly circular, searching flight, northwest up to the frontal zone, a few hundred miles eastward along the front, and then home. The nourishment was spotty and fleeting, and she kept moving. Amelia's restlessness is contagious, and I'm feeling it. I've kept moving, too, this time, to the outer reaches of this island chain. In languid loneliness, at the extreme center of the vast North Pacific Ocean, lies Midway Atoll. It's farther from just about everything than just about anywhere. Virtually no island is more distant from the peopled continents, or more worth the trip. I've come with the award-winning Canadian nature writer, Nancy Barron, to see the world's largest colony of Lazen albatrosses, several hundred thousand exquisite masters of the art of air, a feathered nation convened to breed, cramming two small islands. Parts of this island bloom with thousands of chicks per acre, five-month-old chicks nearly the size of geese, so jammed the sandy landscape that it resembles a poultry farm. They're at an awkward stage, half puffy down, half feathered. Midway is a classic Pacific atoll, mostly shallow lagoon clasped by a thin necklace of emergent broken reef. It has two main islands, Sand and Eastern. The larger, Sand, is about 2 miles across at its widest. The atoll's lagoon is about 5 miles across. Midway's emergent lands total a little over 2 square miles. Compared to Lazen's 1.5 square miles and Tern Island's mere 37 acres, seabirds of 15 species nest here. Though exotic, Midway Atoll feels strangely familiar. Midway is like small-town USA, plus 2 million seabirds. The odd leave-it-to-beaver familiarity derives from the structural remnants of a U.S. military presence that spanned the Second World War through the Cold War. Sand Island's gravel streets connect a network of houses with very American lawns, a very American bowling alley, a tennis court, a small theater, dorms, several small stores, and a workers' bar called the All Hands Club. Energizing the infrastructure is a power generation station built for up to 5,000 military personnel. The power station currently serves only 1/20th its capacity for the following reason. On June 30, 1997, the last of the Navy occupants pulled out. Unneeded buildings started coming down, and this became Midway Atoll National Wildlife Refuge. On all the lawns and lining the airport and on every grassy slope are so many albatrosses. They are everywhere you look, every few feet, on every street or path, outside every window, albatrosses. The youngsters are everywhere. You have to walk around them or zigzag your bike to avoid them, whether you're going to the cafeteria or the beach, wherever you're going. You need to get around albatrosses to get there. If you're walking with someone, you must frequently part to step around albatrosses. At the outdoor Christian chapel, where a round fluorescent bulb serves as Mary's perpetually lit halo, a fairy tern drifts by like a tiny moving cloud, seemingly sanctified and blessed in all aspects and regards. It hovers over the statue like a visitation of the Holy Spirit. With appropriate reference and reverence, Nancy gasps, "Oh, my God," she says. The fairy terns seem so ethereal they could be the souls of babies. The chapel is surrounded by a low white picket fence to keep the albatrosses out. The albatrosses don't mind. They get closer to God on their own power. The albatross chicks have by now grown large, their sleek body feathers mostly in, but their heads still fluffy. They're still unsteady, and you'll sometimes see a big, regal-looking chick suddenly lose its balance like a hiccuping drunk. Nancy squeezes my arm and laughs. "This is the most fun place I've ever seen. We're so lucky to be here." Tourists have been able to come to Midway on commercial flights from Honolulu since the military left. The number of visitors is limited to 100, but civilian travel to Midway isn't unprecedented. In 1935, Pan American Airlines began operating the China Clipper, a large flying boat whose island-hopping itinerary from San Francisco to Honolulu and then to Midway, Wake, Manila, and finally Macau was the fastest and most luxurious route to the Orient. But a Clipper trip cost 3 times the average annual American salary. Only the wealthiest industrialists and luminaries like Ernest Hemingway had the honor of meeting the Goonie Birds face to face. Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor, its first Hawaiian venture since the feather poaching days, ended the China Clipper era. On Japan's next visit, Japanese forces showered their attention on Midway itself. Just as Midway's albatrosses actually spend most of their time on the ocean, most of the Battle of Midway was fought at sea, far over the horizon from the atoll itself. Between the attacking Japanese fleet and bombers from an ambushing American flotilla, the American ships were sent from Pearl Harbor after genius cryptanalyst Joseph Rochefort and his team cracked Japan's war code, enabling the Americans to eavesdrop on the attack plan. By the end of the day-long battle, nearly 400 Americans and some 3,000 Japanese were dead. Japan lost 4 aircraft carriers, and its plan to wipe U.S. resistance from the Pacific had turned to a crippling defeat from which Japan's war effort would never recover. Decades later, President Richard Nixon met Vietnamese leaders here for secret talks to end a dreadful war. Midway's progress from triggering battle to facilitating conciliation was appropriate, because overall this place is much more suited to peace. Now bombs and bullets are a distant memory. Nautis line the phone wires like starlings. Instead of sparrows, flocks of introduced yellow canaries flit from tree to lawn. Fairy terns by the thousands load the lampposts, street signs, and trees. Wildlife, not warfare, is why people come here now. 8 out of 10 visitors arrive for the birds, the rest for fishing and diving. We're here for a little of each. Peter Pyle is a noted seabird scientist whose research assistants at Midway are volunteers signed up through the Oceanic Society. Some are seniors participating as part of an elder hostel group. It's an ideal way for a retiree or anyone to become an instant biologist during a vacation's brief duration. Without these ecotourist dollars to keep the planes flying between here and Honolulu, wildlife management and research would be sharply curtailed, and Midway would be like Lazen, a lonely outpost, difficult to reach, many days distant from medical attention. The volunteers are assisting Peter in applying individually numbered leg bands to the big albatross youngsters. Each identification, fundamental to many wildlife studies, will be appreciated by the next generation of biologists who will come of age during these albatrosses' long lives. Peter selects one large chick after another, applies a band to each chick's leg, closes it with pliers, and checks it to make sure that its ends are smoothly joined and it can rotate freely around the leg without causing abrasion. At one point, we pause, astonished, to watch two downy-headed albatross chicks dancing as though courting. They're awkwardly head-bobbing, wing-flaring, sky-pointing, bill-fencing and clacking, but without the usual vocalizations. Their moves are stiff, not fluid, but unmistakably part of the prepackaged courtship program. Like children in their first crush, they seem confused about whether their interaction is aggressive or not, frequently interrupting their shuffle to bite each other. After a few minutes, the love puppies lose interest in the romance dance. Nancy, enchanted and amused, remarks that the awkwardness of youth seems universal, but while we may delight in their youthful awkwardness, we would err to see them as comedy. Their mere existence is testament to their unlikely success up to now. However cute we may think them, everything about them is geared toward one unlikely gamble: surviving. Mostly albatross chicks all over the island are sitting passively, shunting all their food to growth, wasting hardly a calorie on movement. At this stage, they're both pitifully homely and painfully hungry. Many a chick has been waiting more than a week for a meal while its parents search the limits of the ocean for food enough to keep it alive. Even through their feathers, many young albatrosses look very thin. This is the beginning of their most difficult period, when food needs are highest and their parents are pressed to their limits trying to find enough for such large youngsters. Not all of them can survive. I say, there's a lot of pain in paradise. Peter says, El Nino probably caused food shortages that triggered the drop in the number of adults breeding and increased the nest abandonment. Plus, with El Nino, we lost a lot of the breezes. It's been so calm and hot that I think the heat, dehydration, is killing a lot of chicks right now. Of the birds breeding here, Peter is most concerned about the black-footed albatrosses. There are only about one-tenth as many black-footeds as Lazens to begin with, and in addition to other difficulties, such as oppressive weather and fishing, black-footeds are having more problems with contaminants. Scientists expected to find the world's most uncontaminated birds at Midway because of its remoteness. They were astonished to discover albatrosses with contamination levels comparable to eagles and water birds around the Great Lakes. Black-footed albatrosses, but not Lazens, carry enough chemicals to cause low levels of egg breakage and embryo death, reducing their breeding success by around 2-3%. That black-footed albatrosses can't absorb more fatalities without entering long-term decline. Why these contaminant problems for black-footeds and not Lazens? The compounds called PCBs, whose chemistry predisposes them to affect fertility, embryo growth, immune and endocrine system functions, and cell growth, can be 10 times more concentrated in sea foam than in seawater because they bind to the fats in the foam, the flying fish eggs that blackfoots so relish. They eat far more of them than do the Lazens, are basically bags of fat-rich yolk soaking in parts of the sea surface already enriched with contaminants. One more survival strategy gone awry. Of the hundreds of thousands of chicks that hatched, each night 300 to 350 of the big chicks die. many from starvation and dehydration. Each morning, a white, shrouded worker driving a little tractor and cart makes his rounds using a sharp-tined pitchfork to garner a harvest of death. As if to affect a sinister anonymity, his face is hidden with a loosely wrapped cloth, his eyes obscured by sunglasses. He's a grim but compassionate reaper, shaking his head as he stops to skewer up a bird that expired the previous night, saying in his Sri Lankan accent, "They get bigger, more now die. Not good. More will die than will survive to adulthood." So you wonder at times whether the main process of life is dying. Yet survivors by the thousands await their sea trials. Peter tells us that more than a million albatrosses are now using Midway. 90% are laysan albatrosses, over 300,000 nesting pairs of laysan adults, plus chicks, plus one subadult non-breeder for every two breeders. Laysans have proved very resilient over the years. The feather hunters had knocked the laysans down to as low as perhaps 10 to 12,000 pairs at the beginning of the 20th century. Then from the 1940s to 60s, the military tried to eliminate them from much of Midway. They bulldozed incubating birds and at one point even used flamethrowers. Before military intelligence figured out that albatrosses won't nest on pavement and that they could just pave the areas where they didn't want them, they killed 140,000 birds. They finally stopped killing albatrosses in 1965, but another 60,000 died in collisions with Midway's poles, towers, 300-foot antennas with their guy wire riggings and barbed wire. Lobbying on behalf of the birds had no effect on the military, but in 1967, satellites made the system obsolete. Only after removal of the antenna system and final closure of the base in 1993 could the world's largest albatross colony finally nest in peace. In the evening, Nancy and I introduce ourselves to David Aitano, a fish scientist. He, in turn, introduces us to a fairy-turned chick named Tinkerbell, who stands ready to fledge from the backyard bench on which she hatched. On Midway, this is networking. David Aitano has a broad, open face, brown, soft eyes, and features that reflect his Japanese-American heritage. Around here, he's often presumed to be local Hawaiian. David's father, a biochemist, put the fishing bug in young Dave during frequent excursions around Chesapeake Bay and Maine. Dave would say, "When I grow up, I want a job where they pay me to go fishing." Mission accomplished. Dave's current job is research into the populations and movements of tunas in the Pacific. He studies their travels by putting numbered tags into thousands of fish, releasing them and seeing where other people recapture them. Dave has generously offered to take us with him for a day of tagging yellowfin and big-eye tuna at a sunken seamount 40 miles from Midway. Even at face value, this prospect would rate as sensational. Even more exciting is that these waters have been off limits to fishing boats for about 50 years because of the former military base. The place we're going remains as close to untouched as any place in the open ocean can claim to be. As Robert Frost exclaimed, "May something go always unharvested, may much stay out of our stated plan," unquote. Tapping the same vein, Thoreau observed that a person is rich in proportion to the number of things they can afford to leave alone. A few places should be left to thrive unhindered, so we can have some means to measure the effects we exert everywhere else. How else will we be able to know whether humanity is becoming richer or more impoverished? Precious few places in the world could apply for the distinction of unspoiled. The place we're headed for qualifies. What we'll get a sense of is this: what a piece of ocean can be like when virtually no one has been there for half a century. Nancy and I walk toward the boat in post-midnight darkness. In the open areas around us, occasional Bonin petrel chicks are fledging straight from their burrows. These young birds have never seen daylight, never yet flown. A young Bonin petrel must, in one step, come out into the real world, find the sea, and begin its life-or-death odyssey of living, traveling, and finding food in the ocean, all on its own, all at once. We meet at the appointed hour and load the boat with the needed fishing rods, lures, and tagging gear. The boat is a cabin cruiser usually used for midway's sport fishing charters. The captain is David Wolf. Rounding out the crew is mate Mike Meredith. Mike has been here only 2 weeks and loves it. "For me, it's the opportunity of a lifetime," he says. We leave behind the faint, quaint lights of Midway Atoll under a quarter moon with Mars and Jupiter in uncommonly close consort. Running through the Black Sea in the ink of night entails the hazard of striking a drifting log or other object, so we will go slowly, giving us about 4 hours to talk and snooze. I'll end there. We'll continue next week on the boat with David Aitano, headed out to one of the most pristine, untouched areas of the Pacific or of any ocean in the world, to accompany him conducting his research on big-eyed and yellowfin tuna. I've been reading from Eye of the Albatross, Visions of Hope and Survival by Carl Safina. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.